We've got a very active campaign on the drills right now where assays should finally start to be released pretty quickly here, where we're doing huge step outs up to 800 meters further along strike while we get our permitting in a row this year. So, from a high level, this project, based off our last PEA, which was just released at the very end of March, we've got something just without adding another ounce. Is poised to produce 7 million ounces per year over an 11-year mine life at $17.44 all-in sustaining costs.
Hello everyone, Steve Yang here, Natural Resource Stocks. Great to have you and on Andrew Pollard. Andrew is president and CEO of BlackRock Silver. Andrew, how are you doing today?
It's really good to be here. Thanks for the information, invitation.
Absolutely. Andrew, for those who don't know the story, the website, the ticker, if you can give us just a brief how to find you.
Yeah, well, we trade on the TSX Venture under BRC, and we're quite tradable on the OTCQX under BKRRF. Our website's blackrocksilver.com. BlackRock Silver, we're focused on advancing our flagship project called Tonopah West, which we presented over Discovery 6 years ago and are now in the permitting phase. So this is a unique mix of grade, jurisdiction, easy metallurgy, and ability to be driven forward very quickly, just given the fact that we're on private land in Nevada. And it's something that is poised to be one of the lowest cost silver primary mines in the world if we can advance it and make it the way we see it based off of our PEA.
So, Andrew, you went from discovery, now you're going to development. What do you think you have, first of all, and what have you done so far?
Oh, yeah. Well, listen, it was 6 years ago this week, I believe, that we announced our discovery hole. And really, it's not a new discovery so much as it is a rediscovery because we're picking up right from one of the most prolific silver camps in North America, as the first group to really consolidate what we saw as being the unmined extension, picking up right from where these historic miners left off. So, to put it this way, the Tonopah Silver District between 1900 and 1930 produced about 400 million silver equivalent ounces. And what's really unique about it is it's just silver and gold. So, you break that down, it was 178 million ounces of silver and 1.8 million ounces of gold. And what's really impressive about that, despite the 100-to-1 silver to gold ratio was all of that production came from just 7.5 million tons. So that means two things. It means it's really, really high grade, and the metallurgy here is phenomenal. The old timers just using stamp mills left very little meat on the bones. And we're the first group to come in and reconsolidate this package. It's the largest land holding in this historic district now. First group to bring modern exploration to it. And we, 6 years ago, once we got drills there, we figured a good place to start was right at the last producing mine. So, at the time we said if the historic records were correct, we'll hit where they stopped mining. The vein was said to be 24 meters thick, and our first drill hole hit 30 meters of a kilogram per ton silver equivalent. And here we are, 6 years later, probably about 200,000 meters worth of drilling. All of that 400 million ounces of production was done over a 4.5 kilometer strike length. And in the 6 years that we've had the project now, we've drilled what looks to be cohesive, intact mineralization spanning about 5.5 kilometers. So we've effectively drilled out another Tonopah Silver District in the span of 6 years. We've got a very active campaign on the drills right now where assays should finally start to be released pretty quickly here, where we're doing huge step outs up to 800 meters further along strike while we get our permitting in a row this year. So, from a high level, this project, based off our last PEA, which was just released at the very end of March, we've got something just without adding another ounce. Is poised to produce 7 million ounces per year over an 11-year mine life at $17.44 all-in sustaining costs. So this is something that is poised to be amongst one of the lowest cost silver producers in the world. We're in the best, unequivocally the best jurisdiction in the world, right next to a town. So, we're not in Timbuktu needing to permit power lines or move roads. I mean, we've got everything right there, including people. This time next year, we hope to be breaking ground. So this is one of the few projects that, is going to be permitted and break ground and ultimately start, test mining and doing large bulk samples and, have significant revenue potential probably in 2028. And then it's just a matter of, making sure our model is correct and then ultimately feasibility soon thereafter. And it won't be too much long after that that we'll be working towards full nameplate capacity.
Andrew, who else is in the area? I know you're in the Silver State. You're in a very friendly jurisdiction. You've got the infrastructure, it sounds like. Who else is there? And do you have comps that you can give us? And if you can tell us a little bit about your market cap.
Well, yeah, listen, the Walker Lane, I don't think it hasn't been this hot since, the early 1900s. But what you've seen in the past 4 or 5 years is massive consolidations in some of the biggest companies in the world establishing positions. So, two towns over from us in Beatty, Nevada, AngloGold Ashanti is now driving forward. They've consolidated what looks to be about 25 million ounces of gold. And they're, going full force in terms of driving that forward and realizing it. Centerra Gold is going to be breaking ground on their project called Gemfields, which is one town over, maybe 25 minutes from our project. And they're, from what I understand, are in the process of awaiting all their long lead items, but they're going to be breaking ground at the tail end of this year. Now, we're unlike any other company down there. In fact, you mentioned the Silver State. Nevada is known as the Silver State largely because of our project, the Tonopah Silver District. In terms of historic production, the Tonopah Silver District is only sitting behind the Comstock Lode. So the Tonopah Silver District's called the Queen of the Silver Camps. The Comstock would be the King. Now, the difference between the two is the Comstock was just a massive gold endowment that had a lot of silver with it. With ours is the highest silver to gold ratio of anything you'll find in Nevada, and I think just about anything else in the world right now, at that 100-to-1 silver to gold ratio. So, it's hard to put comps against just gold projects, as we're, a mix of gold and silver. About, a little under half of our economics are related to gold, so it's not bad when that's your pesky byproduct. But there's not really any other comps. The comps you'd use to really look at us would be the other silver developers. And ultimately, if you want to get a vision of what we'd look like once we're producing at that nameplate capacity, it would be those, mid-level producers. I know, if you look at any other company producing 7, 8 million ounces a year at under $20 all-in sustaining costs, you're looking at something that's going to be a multi-billion dollar valuation. When we came in, when we made our discovery, well, actually, when we just picked the project up, we were $7 million market cap company. Here we are today, depending on the, day-to-day gyrations, I think we're somewhere around $400 million market cap. So, yeah, it's come a long way, but if we advance this as expediently as it's looking like we can, that's the upside. That upside is, becoming a producer and ultimately achieving that nameplate capacity.
So, in terms of you mentioned the market cap, where you were, where you've been, where you hope to be. Normally, I would ask about the Lassonde curve, but for those listeners who, what inning are you in?
Well, that's a great no, that's a fantastic question. We've got a very unique setup in the sense that our Lassonde curve is far more truncated than a typical company's because our entire project's on what's known as private land or patented claims. And what that allows us to do, I mean, a lot of people talk about, silver being added to the critical minerals list and does that help you with their permitting? It helps a lot of other companies down there, certainly in America, because they are trying to jog development of domestic assets to bring more on. We were always looking at an expedited permitting process because by being on patented land, We don't deal with the federal government whatsoever in our permitting process. It's just the county and the state of Nevada. So it's a lot fewer desks for our file to sit stale on along the way. So, we're, at the tail end of our permitting process. Everything that we're doing right now, should put us in a position to break ground on our initial underground decline, by, mid to late summer of next year. And ultimately from there, we'll be working our way down into the guts of the system and, aim to be stacking high grade ore at surface in 2028. The Lassonde curve, the number one risk in mining, it's not geology, it's not metallurgy, it's typically time, because you'll see companies just lag, sitting in permitting purgatory for 5 or 10 years, and it's a will they, won't they. We've never had any doubts that this thing's gonna get greenlit. In fact, directly abutting our project on federal land is a big bulk tonnage heap leach gold operation. Ours is a small footprint, and it's shovel ready. It's shovel ready. So it was able to get full federal permits very, very quickly. And this was in the previous administration. Our project is a one portal entry, small footprint, very small. We're not moving a lot of dirt, and it's going to be highly economic, highly robust, and it's going to generate a lot of money for both the state and the county. So, we've gone quicker than just about any other company in the industry, from presiding over a vein-hosted discovery hole to being permitted, to be breaking ground, and ultimately to be unlocking those gold and silver ounces, seeing them for the first time in 20 million years in the span of in the same decade.
Angie, you mentioned private lands and the advantage it gives her in terms of expediting the permitting process. When I think of permitting, there's no better place than Nevada. So is the private land not, I'm curious, is it an inconsequential benefit because Nevada is so fast, or does it really, how much of a difference
It
does it make?
shaves off it shaves off once again it shaves off just a lot of the various desks and a lot of the federal agencies. So by being on private land, we effectively circumvent the whole NEPA process. We still do a ton of environmental data collection, and in fact, that's the longest lead item, of which we've been working diligently for the last, coming up a year and a half to 2 years, in terms of hydrology and waste rock characterization, and looking at acid generation and mitigation strategies and all of that. So we're doing the same amount of work that's required, but it's a very defined process with defined timelines. And the state of Nevada absolutely knows what they're doing in terms of permitting mines. We're not going into a new area. This is the heart of mining country. But aside from the other. Aside from just the permitting advantages that Nevada has, I mean, even just recently, it ranked once again as the number one mining jurisdiction in the world, based off of investor attractiveness. One of the other big things going for it is it's just got rule of law. It's got infrastructure already in place, and most importantly, it's safe, right? We're the only security you need at our project moving forward will be at the casino right next door. There's no issues, right? Like, so this is a very unique, in mining, you typically have to go to some very brutal, some very far-flung places where you're mixing, scatterbrain land holdings with 100 different interested parties. You've got cartel issues, you've got rule of law issues, you've got governments ultimately trying to get their hands in the pot at every different way. You've got obviously indigenous issues. With us, we've got none of that. Like, it's Nevada is great, but ultimately being on private land, especially with our proximity to infrastructure, this is one of the best setups in mining. And I don't care what commodity you're talking about building. In fact, right at the base of our project is a brand new 15 megawatt substation, right? Like, for our drilling, we hook up to the utility, we hook up to fire hydrants to fill our water trucks. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that.
No. You addressed some of the potential risks that investors like myself would be concerned about. If you can talk a little bit about the upside, and my understanding is that you guys are not just one giant ore body, but potentially a high grade epithermal veins. If you can talk a little bit about that, and if you can also address the you saying that gold being the pesky little brother. I know that most silver companies that say they're silver aren't really silver. You seem unique in that. If you can tell us what advantages does that really give you?
I mean, it means you got to, gold is all faithful. Effectively, the way our economics break ground is, or sort of hammer out is that effectively gold pays our bills, and then silver we'd be producing at either even or quite a bit negative cash costs, depending on the price we're able to realize. At our base case economic, I'll put it this way, in at the end of January, silver was $120. Today it's about 60. If you cut that in half and get down to $31, that's what we ran our economics on for our base case scenario for our PEA, which came out at the beginning of March. At that time, I got a lot of flack. Why are you using 31? Why are you using 31? I said, because I want to show that this project works in any pricing environment. And at $31 silver, so if silver gets, it's already been cut in half and then you cut in half again, we're still looking at a 28% after-tax IRR and a 2.5 to 1 NPV to CapEx ratio. Up here at $60 plus, it's well over. Well, I know it's $67 silver. We're looking at an after-tax NPV of $1.55 billion. So what that means is this works in low price environment just because of the grade and because of the really easy metallurgy, but we've got a lot of torque to the upside. And effectively the higher gold and silver go in tandem, the more we verge on negative byproduct costs, right? Or silver costs, right? So but this is something that's very unique. It's got the grade metallurgy, and our CapEx is only $190 million to build. So, it's a classic low sulfidation epithermal system. It's no different to a lot of the other gold mining projects out there that I'm sure have been on there. What makes our project really unique is it's the same sort of system, but it's just got a really, really high silver to gold ratio. Typically you might see 10 to 1 silver to gold ratio. With us, it's about 100 to 1 in terms of what you're going to be pulling out of the ground. So that makes it really unique. But it also lends itself to really cheap processing costs because, you mentioned there's a lot of silver companies or companies that call them silver companies, but they're really lead, zinc, gold. They've got a bit of everything mixed in. And sure, that's great to pad your economics and all of that, but you ultimately have to be able to recover that, and it takes a lot of processes. So we don't have to do a lead and zinc concentrate. We don't have to get smelters involved. We don't have to go through extra steps on the flow sheet like flotation. Ours, you just grind it, you crush, you grind, and then at the end of the day, you're left with gold, silver, and beach sand. So not only are we one of the highest grade silver development projects in the world, I think we've got the cleanest metallurgy of just about anyone in the world. Because there's nothing else in there. Even if it's even a small amount of lead or zinc in there, that still means you have to get it out of there. With us, we will be one of the few projects globally in the silver business that's a doré at site. So, makes for less hands in your pocket along the way.
Andrew, I saw that. I think, if correct me if I'm wrong, Eric Sprott is involved with your company. If you can share a little bit about kind of what he saw, what the conversations were had, that that when an investor like Eric Sprott gets behind a project, it's worth talking about. So if you can just kind of tell me how that process went, and how much does he own, and if you can talk about the share structure a bit, not only in terms of shares outstanding, but options, warrants, and who else is involved here.
Well, Eric's been fa absolutely fantastic to us as investors go. He's acquired through both in the market and through some various private placements, a position that I think right now is about 17%. So he's easily our largest shareholder. And what's even better about him is he's never sold a single share. Certainly last year we made a lot of headlines because Eric was buying hand over fist in the summer months. It even got us into the Globe and Mail here in Canada, our biggest newspaper, because he was just supporting in the market because he saw something at the time. And ultimately he's been proven correct in terms of how our various technical reports came out along the way. He first started investing in us, I think, well, he called us for the first time the day after we made our discovery hole in July of 2020. I originally approached him in his office before that, and at the time what I was saying sounded too good to be true. We said, listen, as I said, we're here to prove that the old timers didn't stop mining because they ran out of gold and silver. They stopped mining due to some technical issues of the day, which was namely the reliability of electricity and how it affected their water pumps. And I just said, if we're right, this is going to be 24 meters thick, and we'll prove that this thing's going to keep going. And didn't believe us, turned us down on that pre-drilling round where we raised $4 million at 20 cents in June of 2020. He waited till after our discovery hole, and then he wrote, I think, $5 million check into us at like 75 cents or something. So, and since then, he's just been acquiring more and more shares. The last placement he did was our last placement in January of this year, where he wrote his biggest check ever into us, which was $7 million, all at higher and higher and higher levels. So he's been absolutely phenomenal. And more phenomenal than that is, listen, when you get someone like Eric in your contact list, he becomes a brain bank that you can draw upon. I've certainly called him to pick his brain, both about the markets, about strategy, just about the market at large. And he's got an intuition that's unlike any person I've ever come across in the industry. And he's a unique breed. He's having his money is great, but having him as a resource to call upon when you need him, is even
Yeah.
better. Yeah. So he's re
And
irreplaceable.
you said he's got 17%.
Yeah, so he's got 17%. So you asked about our share capital right now. At last check, I think we're around 375 million currently issued and outstanding. And on a
Okay.
fully diluted basis, I think we come out to around 404. So, that difference there, it's largely warrants. There are some options and some RSUs and such, but there's not a major overhang there. In terms of capital right now, our share structure has actually put us in a unique position. And what I mean by that is, we just filed our Q2 financial statements a couple weeks ago. So as of April 30th, we had $25 million in the bank. Now, what's unique about that is, as of January 31st, which was our year end, we had sorry, Q1, we also had $25 million in the bank. And
Is
now,
this Canadian or US?
this is Canadian. Now, what I'm getting at is, we've had so much warrant money come in the door over the last year that effectively everything we've done at the project level since the start of the year has been funded by warrants. We had a large tranche of warrants expire in January, all which were significantly in the money. We had another large tranche of warrants expire at the end of May, of which I think Eric owned the lion's share. So he gave us another check for, I think it was $3.2 million in May. And subsequent to April 30th, we've had another, say, $3 to $3.5 million come in. We've had all this warrant money come in the door because, we've been one of the better performers. Certainly last year, we won TSX Venture Top 50. We were one of the top performers last year on the OTCQX, and our volume had absolutely surged too. So, this year, our entire program on the drills this year is going to be about $15 million. I think we've spent about $10 million of that already. So another $5 million to go. And we haven't even dented our treasury yet because we've just had warrants pretty much offsetting our spend. So this is a very unique position for a company like us to be at. And we still have another $7 million or so of in the money warrants that we should see come in the door between now and January of next year. So, we'll get through probably this whole year on the drills and on our work programs, advancing the story. And I don't expect our treasury to budge whatsoever, so it's kind of interesting.
Are you not anticipating any additional financing for the foreseeable future is what I'm kind of picking up?
The biggest re-rate that we're staring at right now, the re-rates come as the project switches. So,
Yeah.
oftentimes you'll see a big jump when a pre-discovery story makes a discovery. The next one is if a pre-discovery story gets to a resource estimate and it outperforms. The next one is it gets to economics. Now we've done all that. The biggest re-rate I think we'll ever have, at least have had thus far, both in a dollar percentage basis and also just on a percentage basis will be once we go and get all the permits we need to break ground, because that's where we go from a developer to someone that's shovel ready, right? So that's when we stop trading in relation to our PEA base case scenarios or whatever, but and we start trading closer to an emerging producer would, because it's actually going to be pretty quick for us to start generating revenue after that. So that valuation jump goes once the market starts valuing based off of what our project's actually worth today, based off gold and silver prices, because we'll be that close to realizing it. And the biggest risk will be in the rearview mirror, which is getting out of permitting purgatory and having big yellow trucks show up at the project. So we expect to have our permits, in place to allow us to break ground by, mid to late summer of next year. And then, that puts a huge target on our back, but it also puts us that much closer to making some money.
Andrew, I'd like to ask you just briefly about yourself, just kind of the background you come from, who you have around you to support you, and if you can, I'd like to ask you, where's the biggest risk in all this? Because there's a lot of upside, it seems. You've mitigated a lot of the risk that we talked about. What are the biggest risks that you see, and what news do we have to look forward to?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, my background, I've been in mining since I was 20, so I'm over 2 decades now. I just turned 41. And I got through, I wasn't your average kid. I've looked the same age since I was, about 18, which worked really well for me in high school for other reasons. But I was also quite motivated. And I just knew that I had no safety net. So I got into business at a very, very young age. I was going to conferences on personal leadership and sales and psychology since I was 16. And I just knew that, I had to make my own break. So I got involved in business. I saw a big gap in mining in the early 2000s as the industry was moving forward and they couldn't get people. At the end of the day, mining companies are two things: they're projects and people. The third thing is capital, but capital only comes if you have the other two. And
Yeah, the
companies,
first two.
yeah, exactly. And companies typically are built just purely based off the project. And I said, well, I saw a huge gap. So I got involved in the executive search business really, really young. I started working for a publicly traded international company. They taught me the business there. And then I saw the opportunity, which was this underserved industry, which was mining, that was wildly cyclical, so much so that it scared the big boys from trying to get into it. And I said, well, if I can come in and overserve an underserved market, there's probably something to be done here. So when I was 20, maybe 21 years old, I started my company. I called it the Mining Recruitment Group. And I just, through immersion, developed this little black book. I placed my first CEO in the industry when I was 21 years old. And over time, over the what followed over the next 15 years, I worked behind the scenes and in the boardrooms of pre-IPO explorers to some of the largest mining companies in the world, $100 billion plus companies, who are having me lead searches for them. And I got to just get to know the who's who, both building boards, building executive teams, helping companies go, well, starting from scratch, a blank sheet of paper, to companies going from exploration to developer to production, because various
Yeah.
stepping stones along the way. And that's what I did. And over time, executive search happens to be probably the highest paying unregulated professional sort of service business you can have. So I started writing bigger and bigger checks into the mining industry. And ultimately, I happened on BlackRock, not because I wanted a job, but because I was what was shaping up to be a very spurned investor. So I started investing BlackRock in 2018. At the time, it was the largest single check I'd ever written to a company. And I was so myopic about the project that they'd optioned at the time. It's another project of ours called SilverCloud, that I didn't really look at the team. And ultimately, the headhunter, someone whose entire business was predicated on one thing, management matters, got burned because he was focused on something else. So fast forward a year later, the company was effectively insolvent. It wasn't circling the gutter, it was halfway down the drain. And I just sort of read the riot act to the whole team, and I just said, listen, if this is the best you guys can do, step aside. I saw it as a unique challenge to see if what I'd been doing was real or not, or whether I was just, collecting fees. And I came in with a very simple mandate. I was going to join on an interim basis. I saw the company had good bones. It had a good share structure. It had a great asset that you could build a company around, but it needed some screws to turn at the team level. So I came in and was just going to open up my little black book, and I went about rebuilding the board. So when I joined in May of 2019, 3 cents, $800,000 Canadian market cap. And the first hire I made was a guy named Bill Howell. Bill Howell joined us as executive chairman the week after. Now, Bill has drilled out over 100 million ounces of gold in his career. He was the former head of exploration of Placer Dome, which was a major mining company that was taken out by Barrick for, I think, $10 billion in 2010. And he had oversight over all of their assets in Nevada. So he was a good guy to know. I brought in a major mining explorationist into what was a million-dollar market cap company at that time. And 6 months later, Bill brought me the Tonopah Silver consolidation opportunity. So I hired the right person to really run the show at the project level, and then I listened to him. And along the way, I've always focused on this is a people-first company. We've got now one of the best boards in junior mining. Every single person on our board has built, started, or played a part of multi-billion-dollar companies, starting with my chairman. This is a fantastic board of operators, and they've been a unique counsel for me, and that's grown. You've seen various changes. The dynamic of the company, of the board, typically precedes the company going to the next level, and you've seen similar changes just this year. We brought on two very a director from MAG Silver coming off a big win. We brought on general counsel of just a host of silver companies along the way, but most notably SilverCrest and Endeavor Silver to our board, someone that's seen everything and worked there. So we've got a really, really diverse board with engineers and mine builders and financiers. Certainly geology were covered. And now we're focused on taking the company, the operations team to the next level, because we're switching gears very quickly. So we've got a big executive search underway to bring on a mine builder who's going to take the project from the geologists and make it the way we see it on paper, right?
No.
The risks, at the project, this is a very straightforward project. The grade profile gives us a lot of wiggle room. This is one of the highest grade silver projects out there in the world. The metallurgy also gives it a lot of wiggle room. And it's a very straightforward process, right? It's, our PEA, very, very conservative assumptions. Minimum mining widths of 3 meters. The CapEx on this thing, it's only $190 million, and that's including a $25 million contingency. We're not doing any exotic mining methods. It's primarily 90% long hole stoping and the remainder cut and fill. So project level, it's straightforward. If there's overages, which often there are, you're looking at minor, this isn't $1 billion plus CapEx. This is, $190 billion, a million. So really, it's just execution. It's getting the people, it's getting materials when you need them, right? So, we're at the point now where it's not a question of if, it's just a question of when we get the permit. So we're starting to look at ordering long lead items. We're starting to for our initial decline and test mining and all of that, and getting offices created. So it's more just everything coming, it's more just timing, getting everything going and ensuring we have the team in place. And that's what we're focused on now.
Andrew, love it. If thank you for giving us the breakdown of that and sharing your story. If you'd be so kind as to give our audience just some information on where to reach out if they have any questions, and if you can give your ticker and your website one more time.
Yeah, well, obviously, we have an IR person, but I prefer doing these things. I love meeting investors. So reach out to me via email directly at andrew@blackrocksilver.com. And once again, our tickers are BRC in Canada and BKRRF in the US. And as I mentioned earlier in the interview, we've been drilling since I think the beginning of March. And these are all step out holes and expansion holes. We should start to see assays rolling out, in very, very short course. And I think what the market's going to be most interested are the massive step outs. We're stepping out 800 meters on multiple vein sets. Those ones we've finished. Well, we've got a couple in the lab which have the potential, should we hit on those, to really, really blow the doors off the upside potential for the project. But at the end of the day, we're not a drill-based story anymore. We don't need to add another ounce. Where the valuation jump for us, the biggest one, and you can set your clock to it, is getting these permits in place, because that's when this gets to the next stage, and those are coming. Those are coming quick.
On private land. For our listeners, I am not, just to disclose, I am not currently a BlackRock silver investor. That may change. Today is the 14th of July. Andrew and BlackRock have not paid for this interview, but I'm not giving investment advice. Please do your due diligence. One of the ways to do that is to reach out to Andrew, follow the ticker, the website, and the story. Andrew, thank you so much for being here and telling us all about BlackRock.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.